Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Cambridge Savings Bank. CSB is committed to improving the financial well-being of local small businesses through financial education and banking services. Learn more at cambridgesavings.com, member FDIC. And M&M Skylights, offering a wide range of Velux skylight products, installation, and maintenance services to customers from Boston to Portland and surrounding areas. More information at mmskylights.com.
I'm Jim Browdy. Today on Boston Public Radio, we'll start the show getting your thoughts on the multiple unidentified objects shot down over North America over the weekend. Is a shoot first, ask later approach the right one? Is it possible we're just aggravating some aliens just out for an exploratory mission? And why isn't the president telling us what's really going on?
I'm Marjorie Egan. A new study has found childbirth is deadlier for black families, even wealthy ones. Black women with high incomes fare about as well as the poorest white women. We'll talk with Michael Curry, head of the Mass League of Community Health Centers, about that and other issues coming up. It's all ahead. Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. How are you?
Excellent, thanks.
So tomorrow we're at the library. Mayor Wu is there for Ask the Mayor from 11 to 12. The Attorney General, the new Attorney General, Andrea Campbell, is there for the first time as Attorney General from 1 to 2. One other thing before we start, Marjorie, you and I were asked to MC this incredible event yesterday called the Winter Walk.
Right.
At Copley, 3,000 to 4,000 people showed up in an effort to advance the cause of ending homelessness. It was really beautiful. Paul English, also deeply involved in the Embrace, one of the leaders of this, Ari Barbanel, the executive director. It is just a fabulous operation. And if you want to check it out and help, if you can, it's winterwalk.org.
Well, you know what was the best thing about it? I thought the videos stories of people who had been homeless through no fault of their own, really, and then wound up getting into housing and what a difference it made in their lives. Those real stories, they were great.
How about when Richie, one of the formerly homeless guys, is just walking through the common and starts singing America?
Yeah.
I mean, oh, my God. In any case, check it out. So a massive Chinese spy balloon, first seen over, I think it was Montana, and then shot down off the coast of South Carolina, has once again raised our collective awareness of unidentified objects in the sky. We know that one was from China, as I say, but the U.S. has now shot down three additional objects in just 3 days since we first learned of the balloon. The military said they don't know what these new objects even are or how they stay aloft, which, of course, has raised our and other people's alarm bells about the possibility of alien craft. U.S. Air Force General Glenn Van Herk, listen to this carefully, said he could not rule out extraterrestrials.
I'll let the intel community and the counterintelligence community figure that out. I haven't ruled out anything at this point. We continue to assess every threat or potential threat unknown that approaches North America with an attempt to identify it.
Well, that's reassuring. So regardless of whether you're disappointed at the likelihood of being beamed up and probed, which is what Marjorie's been hoping for years,
that's
has just
right.
decreased given our military's eagerness for shooting things out of the sky, are you just confused about how we didn't know about these until a month ago? What's going on? And why isn't the president saying something? And should we be worrying? It seems to me people are just making jokes about this thing. It is at least somewhat concerning. 877-301-8970. And I repeat, three shot down in 3 days, and they allegedly, and that's the operative word, don't know where they came from, what they were doing. They don't know nothing about nothing.
Well, I hope they aren't full of little people from other worlds, Jim, because they're no longer in those little aircrafts now. We don't know. I mean, they talked about in one of these stories from CNN about how the number of unidentified flying objects has increased dramatically in the last 17 years, and they've ruled out some of them. Some of them were other kinds of balloons. Some of them were other kinds of just
things that they were could figure out what they were. Drones was a lot of them were drones, but that leaves 171 unidentified object sightings for which no explanation can be found. And I'm always surprised when people think, oh, my God, it can't possibly be a UFO. Well, haven't we just learned from this huge telescope, what's it called, the new one, the James Webb telescope? We are surrounded by other solar systems, by other universes. We look different. The Earth looks different than a lot of places because we're kind of green and we look like something that might be worth investigating. Of course, there are people that are looking.
Well, you know, I know that you're invested in this extraterrestrial thing, and maybe you're. By the way, in seriousness, you may be right. I am concerned. Let me read this text. This person. Do you guys really believe the government does not know what they're shooting down? No, I do not. That they're just flying up there willy nilly and shooting anything that moves. There are rumors this is in preparation to raise the DEFCON level and be prepared for nuclear war. I mean, that's what troubles me. I mean. They do know. And if they don't know, it's a huge problem. And if they do know and they're not telling us, to my way of thinking, that's a huge problem, too.
Well, maybe they're just worried about what Marjorie Taylor Greene will say about President Biden if he doesn't shoot these things down fast enough. The Republicans were up in arms about Biden's allowing this balloon to come across the continental
The Chinese
United States,
balloon, yeah.
Right, before they shot it down. Yeah. It was over the water. And then we found out that they were up there during Trump's presidency. And the people, they didn't even know then because it was a gap in military. But, listen, you think the government is more competent than I do. I'm not sure they know what they are. This could just be a political kind of thing.
What do you mean a political? What does that mean, a political kind of thing?
The idea, there was massive uproar, Jim. I mean, we've had these things.
Wait, finish your thought. I don't know what you mean. What do you mean it's just a political thing?
We have had massive uproar about this Chinese balloon. Have
oh,
we not,
from the Republicans,
days,
yeah.
That we let,
and
now,
some Democrats,
now,
yeah.
I think for years, we had all these sightings for years of UFOs. No one was shooting them down, right? These Air Force pilots were talking about things that they saw.
Oh, right. Remember the hearing. And, there was a big hearing a year or two ago, yeah.
What was always interesting to me is that the aircrafts, whatever they were doing things that our aircrafts couldn't do, like they were kind of stopping in space. They were going backwards. They were going right and left. They were doing all these extraterrestrial kinds of things. Well, the pilots in those airplanes weren't told to shoot them down, were they?
Okay, so I don't know where you... I mean, are you worried about this at all? Are you thinking about this at all? Would you not like the president or somebody with some authority and knowledge to speak to the country? Here's Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader in the Senate, with ABC's George Stephanopoulos, talking about how the U.S. military and intelligence agencies allegedly didn't know about the Chinese spy craft on our airspace until just, I don't know, a couple of months ago. Here it is.
Until a few months ago, we didn't know of these balloons. Our intelligence and our military did not know. This went as far back as President Trump, at least three times.
It's wild that we didn't know, isn't it?
It is wild that we didn't know.
It is wild that we didn't know. And that's the thing that concerns. There's only one of two choices. Either we did know and they're not telling us, or we didn't know, and as I said, which is both of which are equally troubling. Our number is 877-301-8970.
Now, I'd like to say that most of the texters are so far with me.
Well, it's because of you. I mean, it's just.
We need to find Will Smith so he could save us again. That's from Ernie in Everett. And somebody else texts. He recently heard that aliens lock their doors when they fly by Earth because I guess we have crime right here. A crime
Here's a
rate
good
here
one
that's very high.
About aliens. If aliens can traverse the vast distance of our galaxy, do you really think they would allow themselves to be shot down?
Well, a person above that is saying the same thing. Aliens would not allow themselves to be shot down. And apparently, with the way their aircraft can maneuver in space, we wouldn't be able to shoot them down.
Yeah.
So I guess why my question is, why are we suddenly shooting everything down, Jim? They've been around forever, haven't they? These
well, if they're three in three in days, the assumption has to be that they've been there and we either didn't know about them or ignored them, no?
Yes, but I guess what I'm saying that we have had significant sightings of UFOs for not just 20 years. For don't you remember the great story up in New Hampshire about the couple that was driving home one night? I think that was the 50s or 60s, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they saw these unidentified flying objects. They were beamed up in probe, that couple from New Hampshire.
Oh, that was George Santos and his date. That's right. I forgot about them. 877-301-8970. Brian from Paxton is the first person who's taking this seriously.
Mm-hmm.
He says these balloons are frightening. They are frightening.
Well, I guess
it is really frightening.
I guess it's frightening, but don't the Chinese have satellites going all around the world?
No one has explained the balloon thing. I'm so glad you brought that up. The notion that if they were really using this as a vehicle for spying, mm-hmm. they're going to do a damn balloon that is visible. I mean, it's ridiculous. 877-301-8970. By the way, you're not seeing Marjorie on Zoom. Marjorie is mocking this whole exercise. I am acting as a relatively serious public policy person.
I'm mocking the idea that here we are in this huge universe and we're acting like an alien spying on us is bizarre. An alien not spying on us would be bizarre, right?
But if it's spying on us, it's not going to be at a level where it could be, as these texters are saying, where it could be shot down. If they have this incredible technology.
I'm with the texters. No, they wouldn't be shot down. All I'm saying is that I am mocking the idea that UFOs don't exist. Yes,
well, everybody believes they exist.
Really? Well, why doesn't the government say they exist?
Well, I thought didn't the government at those hearings?
No,
last
they never
year?
They never say that. They just say that they're unexplained.
Oh.
They don't want to say that ET was spotted over Montana in a little spaceship.
So you can't have a serious conversation with this woman when it comes to aliens. And by the way, what do you mean by beamed and probed? What exactly?
That's what always happens in these alien stories. The people are beamed up into the spaceship and they do medical exams on them. And then they send them back down.
What do you mean they do medical? Like an MRI?
They're probing, Jim.
What
they're probing and how they're doing it, I don't know. It's a mystery to me, but that's what happens.
Goes back to your holes and souls comment of the other day.
And then they're beamed back down, and then people remember it for the rest of their life. I mean, we're getting pictures of this right now. People were beamed right off a park bench. They were sitting underneath an elm tree.
What town was that in?
I don't know. Jamie hasn't told me that. Oh, it's in Brooklyn.
It's in Brooklyn.
That's right.
Let's go to Steve in Watertown to rescue us. How are you, Steve? What's going on?
Hey, good. How are you guys doing?
We're excellent.
Fine, thanks.
this topic I'm very interested in. I totally believe that there's alien life.
Of course there is.
Visited this planet. There's a show I watch on the History Channel. I don't know if I can plug this.
Yeah, go ahead. Sure.
Called Alien, Ancient Aliens.
Sure.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And this is all they talk about. There's all kinds of evidence all around our planet, all of these ancient stone structures everywhere, including the pyramids of Egypt, Stonehenge.
Stonehenge, that's right.
All right? There's everywhere. You watch the show. I'm telling you, I recommend it.
And we'll watch it.
There's all kinds of evidence that there is life, you know, alien life that has visited our planet since
By the way, just so you don't think that we hung up on that person inadvertently or we lost them or something. You don't think that person or Marjorie are out to lunch here. According mm-hmm. to Pew Research, which is about the most credible operation there is.
They're everywhere, Jim.
Guess what percentage of Americans believe that intelligent life does exist on other planets? I'm shocked.
I would hope it's about 90%.
It's two-thirds. I mean, that's two-thirds. I think it's really high.
Well, by the way,
can I tell you one thing?
The other thing to say is that we're unique in the universe.
I've not finished. 65% believe there's intelligent life on other planets, and only 12%, listen to this, believe there's intelligent life on Earth. I mean, that is really...
Here's my argument. Okay,
what is it?
You know, you look at our solar system. We're the only place that's got lots of.
The most excited Marjorie's been like
we've
in
got,
months.
We've got green hills. We've got flowers. I mean, I hope they last longer than some scientists think they're going to last.
Sure.
And we have a verdant Earth, right? Mars does not have that verdant Earth. Jupiter doesn't have that verdant. Nothing else in our solar system does.
Well, you know, there's other solar systems. You know that, right?
Exactly. But there have to be the right conditions for life,
Life as we know it, Marjorie.
Life as we know it. That's correct. So don't you think that if you are an alien running around and you get to the solar system and you see that there is this one place that looks different than the other planets in the solar system. That's why we're so intriguing, Jim, and that's why we have 171 unexplained flying objects that nobody knows about. And just what is that? How many years is that?
I don't know.
In the last, I think, 7 years? I'll double check it during the break.
So do you believe that someone like, for example, Tucker Carlson is from another planet? What do you believe? right?
He
could be a pod
person. You never know where they're lurking either.
No.
Some of your neighbors, you look out, you watch them in the driveway, you think.
Pod person. Exactly.
Absolutely.
I'll take a break.
We're
they should put Marjorie in charge of this investigation because she really is getting to the core of the issue, don't you think?
We're talking about why we're shooting down all these unidentified flying objects.
No, we're not. We're not talking about why we're shooting them down.
What are we talking about?
We're talking about what's going on and when are they going to tell us the truth and should we be concerned? That's what we're talking about.
Yeah, well, Jim, I think you might be waiting a long time for the truth.
Maybe we will.
But we're going to be right back. We have a quick pledge break. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're at the library tomorrow to ask these. Ask the mayor, 11 to 12, and ask the new attorney general, Andrea Campbell, 1 to 2. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about these unidentified aircrafts. Our military has shot down three in 3 days. Obviously, we're taking a shoot first, ask questions later approach. Apparently, people in Congress like that. I don't know enough to know I like it. And I'm really troubled that we don't know enough. In fact, we don't know anything. This general, this Air Force general that we played sound from earlier in the show, is a big deal, says he couldn't rule out extraterrestrial. Whatever it is, I would like to know more. And I think I'm serious. Joe Biden should say something to the American people. The number is 877-301-8970. Tim in Boston.
Our texters, before we get to Tim in Boston, our texters are very, very concerned about this, too. They want to know, one of them wants to know why President Biden isn't shooting down the Jewish space lasers. Remember them?
Oh, that Marjorie Taylor Greene is talking about
the Jewish space lasers. And Ted from Marshfield says, if it turns out one of these objects is Mary Poppins, I'm going to be very upset.
You know, this is a big laugh-a-thon for you. This is... You have no idea how serious this is, and you probably believe that they really don't know, the government, what's going on. Of course they don't. What are you laughing about?
You know, imagine in all the movies we see about what happens when the aliens arrive, the extraterrestrial, they always come down. They always say the same thing. What? Before they beam you up and probe you, they say, take me to your leader.
No, that was about 50 years ago they said that.
And if an extraterrestrial did come down and say, take me to your leader, we would be very nonplussed by that.
Dan in Cambridge says, they're here to steal our smug mugs. Now that is totally believable to me. Diane in Fairhaven, what's your deal?
Hi. Calling to give rave reviews to the smug mugs, maybe to entice other people.
Oh, you got one of the early ones? What do you think?
Huh? I have the second one.
You do?
Yeah, and when, I was there Friday with my son, and I showed you that I have that one.
Oh, of course. That's right. That's right. I forgot. Yeah.
The second. Anyway, but yes. Drink wine from it, too. It's very good.
Now, by the way, do you not think it's unfair, Diane, since you brought it up, that my bosses have allowed a photograph like this of me to go on a mug available to the public? Is that not problematic?
I don't think so, because it tends to be true sometimes.
Well, thank you for that, Diane. Diane won't be calling anytime soon again. Diane, thank you. Marjorie obviously put you. What's that? Oh, what do you want to say? Okay,
good. And then you're going to cut me off and I can't get through. So,
well, believe me, that just happened. Diane, thank you for the call. We'll forgive you because we like you, actually.
From West Bridgewater says that Marjorie nailed it. False flag op. The Biden administration got so beat up over the balloon, they're playing tough guy. They've probably been letting them fly unmolested for years. And we now know that they were flying unmolested, at least some of them, during the Trump administration when they didn't even know about these things. So there you go, Jim.
By the way, I think it's fair to say that when Biden shot it down, it was in response to the Republican criticism. Would you not say?
Absolutely.
I mean, okay, let's
go. Dave from Maynard, who knows more about this than I do, says a satellite cannot do radiation scans while a balloon can. Surveillance.
What do you mean? How do you
sites.
Know he knows more than you do?
I don't know. Well, I don't know anything about radiation
scans.
He
may be an alien himself. Who the hell knows? Let's go to Jim in
Boston. He could be a Jewish space laser.
Jim in Boston, you're next on Boston Public Radio. What's your deal? Good. Well, that was excellent. Thank you for the call. 877-301. Now the aliens are blocking all of our lines. That's what they do when you start talking about them disrespectfully. We have no idea where to go. Oh, Jim is back. That was our fault. Jim in Boston.
Sorry, Jim.
Hello. Sorry. It was Marjorie's fault. What's up?
I wonder if this is a distraction from stuff going on in D.C., right? There's a lot of bad news coming out of the federal government between Seymour Hirsch's, you know, blog post.
What did he post? What's his blog post? I haven't seen it. What did he post?
Oh, wow. Seymour Hirsch, you know, has a single anonymous source claiming that Biden gave the okay for Nord Stream 2 to be blown up. That came out 3-4 days ago, and no one's really
Read it before we talk about it. Thank you, Jim, for the call. 877-301-8970 is the number. We're talking about shooting down three, they don't call them UFOs, unidentified aircraft in 3 days. That's on top of the, on top of the Chinese spy balloon a couple of days ago. Where should we go next, ladies and gentlemen?
Let's go to.
Let's go nowhere.
Why did Marjorie Taylor? What did she think that the Jewish lasers were shooting down?
I don't know. Let's go to Chris calling from the car. Hi, Chris. What's up?
Oh, hello, Jim and Marjorie. This is my second time getting through to you.
Well, we're thrilled.
And as much as people say they got through the pandemic. I got through before the pandemic with you folks.
Hmm.
I love you.
Thank you.
So anyway, I was just thinking. You know. I'm wondering if this is something that Russia is trying to do to get us a little nervous about what's going on in Ukraine and distract us in that manner. I can't see UFOs sending little balloons. I think they'd send these big spaceships and just zoom us up.
Well, that's actually an interesting point, Chris. Thank you for your second call. We hope you make a third soon.
Okay.
Yeah.
I looked up the Jewish space lasers because I always forget what she was referring to them about, but she thought that she was alleging that the wildfires in California were not the result of climate change. They were the result of Jewish space lasers setting things on fire in California, Jim. And I think we all know that she's onto something.
By the way, getting back to the Seymour Hirsch thing, the White House has responded. I hadn't read the thing before from Hirsch, said it was utterly false, that the United States was behind the explosions of the Nord Stream gas pipelines. They called them utterly false and complete fiction. Shane, if you can do it in 30 seconds, it's all yours. Go.
Hi. Thanks. I just wanted to mention that Marjorie is missing the most important word in UFO, and that is unidentified.
Yeah.
Right.
And if it's unidentified, you can't make the leap to aliens without any evidence. You might as well make the leap to the fact that it's Zeus sending down his demigods to spy on us.
You never know that plausible. Zeus could be rising phoenix-like from the ashes. But you're right, Shane. I cannot jump to the conclusion that they're unidentified flying objects are actually aliens, but there is no explanation. And if there's 171 that can't identify, I don't know, I think the odds might be on my side. But Robin from Shrewsbury points out that George Santos has hailed himself the first extraterrestrial to make first contact on Earth, and he admits, Jim, to probing the couple from New Hampshire. Plus, he built Stonehenge.
I'll tell you, we really advanced the discussion on this. That's one of the things we do beautifully, particularly Marjorie in this case. We'll return. We're actually going to talk to Charlie Sennett, who may actually have some information that will be useful at 12 o'clock about this unidentified aircraft thing.
Yes. We're going to be talking up next to Michael Curry from the Mass League of Community Health Centers. He's going to talk about the disparities between black women, even wealthy women, and the health care they receive and their babies received. Turns out they fare not much better than the poorest white women. We're going to talk to Michael Curry up next. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Tomorrow we're at the library, and as we told you, 11 to 12, Mayor Wu joins us for Ask the Mayor. 1 to 2, Andrea Campbell joins us for the first in what will be monthly Ask the Attorney General. We're joined now on Zoom by Michael Curry. Michael is the president and CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, also a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors, which, by the way, is having its national convention here this summer, where he chairs the board's advocacy and policy committee. Hi there, Michael.
Good morning.
Morning to you.
Good morning, Michael. Well, we would talk to you about this before, but the there's more and more data showing that it doesn't seem to matter how well-to-do you are as a Black woman. You are treated differently. You're experiencing racism in healthcare. In childbirth, mothers are treated differently, given different access to interventions. Black infants are more likely to survive if their doctors are Black, but there's not many Black obstetricians. There's not many Black physicians in general. So what do we make of this? That the and Hispanic and Asian mothers track more closely to white mothers. So what's going on?
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting. We have these conversations. Often people say to me, we don't need any more data. We know what the problem is. And I tend to be one of those people that say, actually, that's not true. Right? Is that we know there's inequities. We know there's systemic racism. At least many of us know. I wouldn't even say all of us know. But the data matters. So when this recent data comes out that says, by the way, if you're a Black person, a Black expecting mother, and you've, you know, gone through the gauntlet of discrimination in society, and you built wealth, and you live in, you know, Chestnut Hill. I'll pick on Chestnut Hill when I say this. And you live in Chestnut Hill, you're likely to have just as adverse an outcome as if you lived in Roxbury or Dorchester, or at least much more of an adverse outcome and a potential death in your pregnancy than if you were a white woman who was wealthy or a poor white woman. All that is pretty disturbing, but I think the data shows that economic success does not eliminate the inequities that exist in our system that has Black and brown women experiencing adverse pregnancy, preterms, complications in their pregnancy, as well as low birth weight babies and deaths of children. We need to now think about systemic issues, and I think all of us are starting to turn our attention to what can be done systemically. And you mentioned some of them.
You know, a couple of things. There's a quote from a woman whose name I forget in this piece in the New York Times commenting on this research from the National Bureau of Economic Research. And it says, I mean, the obvious is not race, it's racism. I mean, and that is pretty obvious. And it seems to me this makes an even more compelling case for what you've been making the case for with this health equity compact thing of yours and 50 plus other healthcare leaders of color who filed legislation and a report on Beacon Hill, is that it's all about social determinants. Is that not? I mean, it's all about the social determinants, no?
Yeah, it is much about the social determinants, right? If we can solve for the conditions that make people sick, the poverty, the cost barriers that keep people from getting access to care, that become an impediment, if we can get them the transportation to make sure and the locality of our medical facilities so that people can get to their appointments, then they'll show up. If we have doctors, nurses, and other clinical staff that look like them, speak their language, know their culture, they'll engage more frequently and in a timely way with our medical system. And then are we thinking differently about how we use technology, how we use doulas, community health workers to engage patients where they are, when they need it, in a way that they can identify with? It's all of the above. But yes, the conditions in which people live matter significantly to the status of their health and their health outcomes. We can do something about all of this if we have the sense of urgency, Jim, that you and I have talked about many times before.
Can I just repeat some of these stats? I know you said them, but they're so stark. This is from the New York Times story. The richest Black mothers and their babies are twice as likely to die as the richest white mothers and their babies. And when they, in this research, they compare...
Poorest white mothers.
No. As richest white mothers and their babies, twice as much.
I'm sorry.
But when it... I'm going to get to your point, Marjorie. When it comes to maternal and infant mortality, the richest Black women suffer at the same rate on both of those fronts as the lowest income white women who have much lower quality of care. So, I mean, again, this may not surprise you, but I think part of what you're saying, Michael, is more data is always welcome. This is like blow the doors off kind of data as far as I am concerned. And people should check it out. Again, it's the New York Times everywhere. The underlying research is from the National Bureau of Economic Research.
You know, and maybe related to that is that we have a broader problem that's not just a BIPOC, a Black patient, Black mother, Black child issue. We have a broader issue, and the article points that out, that mothers are dying and babies are dying. Even wealthy mothers are having adverse outcomes. Now, they tie that, which I thought was fascinating, Marjorie, tying that to wealthier white women are having babies at later ages.
Yes.
And then all the fertility treatments would then lead to preterm births. That was fascinating to me in the whole study and the analysis. But even when they have adverse outcomes or adverse pregnancies, preterm births, their babies are surviving when others aren't.
You know, by the way, for people who are in denial about this, and unfortunately some are, read the I hope you have in the past, read the testimony, for lack of a better expression, of Serena Williams, who really sort of foreshadowed this research in her own life. You can't get more powerful. You can't get wealthier. You can't get more able to access, theoretically, decent health care than you would believe Serena Williams is, but was. But just read her story about childbirth. We're talking to Michael Curry.
Yeah, you know, one last thing before we leave.
I have one last thing after that.
Oh, okay.
Too.
We talked with Dr. Catherine Gergen Barnett about midwives, and she's a physician at Boston Medical Center, family physician, and she was saying that midwives are a lot less lucrative for the hospitals. I mean, I'm not an expert, but I had my first kid with midwives, my other two with physicians, and it's a totally different experience. And we talked about the lack of physicians, of African-American physicians. So we've talked about the doula program for Black women, but it seems like this is such a no-brainer because you don't have to have that level of that. You don't have to go to 7 years or whatever it is to medical school, and maybe you wouldn't encounter the kind of racism that you do in medical school if there were more midwives, because you're such a nervous wreck, especially with your first kid. Right. It's like you're in an adversarial situation with the doctor in the hospital, which is even made worse if you are a woman of color or someone who's not going to go toe-to-toe with the doctor. You know what I mean?
Yeah. My 2023 phrase that I love, and you'll hear me say this a lot in 2023, which is pay now or pay greater later.
Yeah.
So the reality is that we have doulas, we have midwives engaging expecting mothers, engaging families, because it's not just about the mothers, making sure the conditions are right, the mental health, the conditions for having the baby are right, that the engagement with the provider is happening in a timely way, the testing's being done if it's necessary, when it's necessary. If we have that in process, then we save some of the ups or avoid some of the upstream costs, or downstream is actually a better example, downstream costs of NICU units and all these other very costly aspects of care that quite frankly, are driving costs up in the system. So, you know, pay now, pay greater later. Let's put the investment upstream. Let's really invest in mothers when they're pregnant, when they're engaging in their households and their communities. And it's just the right thing to do. And it makes dollars and cents. It makes good sense to do it.
One last very quick thing on this before we take a quick break, Michael Curry. Marjorie, I think, mentioned that in this study, it shows that the outcomes for Black women, including wealthy Black women, are far better if the doctor is a Black doctor. If someone comes in the League of Community Health Centers and happens to get a white or an Asian or a Latino doctor and says, no, 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 the data shows that I will fare far better as a pregnant mother with a Black doctor. I don't want this doctor. I'm sure he or she is a nice person. I want a Black doctor. What do you say to them?
Well, one, we know in a workforce crisis, that's not even possible. Two, we know in a society, in a country where we have not invested in Black and brown physicians, where only 5% of the doctors in this country are Black. Mm-hmm. And it's not because they're not as brilliant as those white doctors that have gone through our systems. We've not even prepared for that, Jim. So that's an impossibility. Yeah. We can't provide you with a Black doctor in many circumstances. But the good thing about health centers is a lot of our physicians do reflect the communities where we serve, not all. I actually believe that whether you're white or Black or brown, you should be able to serve all patients well if you're culturally competent, if you've been trained appropriately. But what it says is if you have a diverse core of providers in a facility, then I may come to you and say, hey, Jim, what do you think of this patient? What are you thinking about how I should respond? That team-based approach to providing care should include voices, faces, perspectives of color, and it doesn't in many settings.
We're talking with Michael Curry. Going to keep talking with him after this quick break. He's from the NAACP Board of Directors nationally and the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, where he's the CEO. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Once again, we're at the library tomorrow, and we're continuing our conversation with Michael Curry from the Mass League of Community Health Centers and the NAACP.
So, Michael, for as long as I've been a reporter, which is going on 40 years, we've talked, described the Department of Children and Families the same way: beleaguered, overwhelmed, underpaid, not given the resources it needs. And here's another story that is a combination of problems, but a 15-year-old that was the mom called DCF for this young man because he was having a lot of problems. But instead of getting help, he wound up spending 40 days in a hospital room with no windows and not very good food. And mom was devastated, and so was the kid. I don't know if we ever, this has got a lot more to do with than DCF and this problem, but it's really insane.
Yeah, it is insane. And I think, right before we jumped on, before I jumped on the call with you, just to talk about how much of a urgency this is, Mayor Sullivan called me from Brockton. Of course, because of Brockton Hospital and Good Sam and the crisis that's happening in on the South Shore, we can't afford for emergency rooms to be crowded. We can't afford for boarding in emergency rooms because we need it for patients. We need it for the people who actually need care. We have a capacity issue. We need it for COVID. We need to make sure that we're prepared for whatever remains of the flu season. And I think ultimately it makes no sense that we cannot solve or have not solved this boarding issue with children in DCF in our emergency rooms, in our hospital system. So I really think, to your point, Marjorie, that this is a problem that's been waiting for a solution. And it's not that complicated. It requires investment. How do we create facilities where our most vulnerable among us, these children who are in the DCF system, can go to get a place where they can get fed, cared for, and it not be in a hospital? As someone who spent as a child a considerable amount of time in the hospital for a crisis I had, I think I was in the hospital for 3 months. To be in the hospital that long with very little windows and light and very little interaction with family is not a good thing. It is actually traumatizing to be stuck in a hospital setting for that long when you're that young of a child.
How old were you, Michael? How old were you when you were in the
hospital? I was seven. I had major burns on both my feet as a child in an accident, and I ended up having 3 months of skin grafts and being in and out of the hospital for 3 months.
Did we say, by the way, did any of the three of us make clear, and if you did, my apologies, while he originally had health problems that murdered going to the ER, he wasn't kept in the ER for 40 days because of health problems.
No.
He was kept in the ER for 40 days because there was no placement. And, I know we only have a minute, so I hesitate to say this, but if the legislature really wanted to solve this, they would value the lives of poor kids more than they do. Almost, Marjorie, you've talked for years, whenever we talk about cars for public officials, who gets the cars, who doesn't get the cars, the social workers. Who makes decent salaries, who doesn't make decent salaries. This is maybe not all fixable, but a lot of it is fixable if people decided poor kids are entitled to the same level of government support that other kids are
entitled. And 48% of the patients we serve as a health centers are Medicaid patients. Yep. Many of them are engaged or off and on in the DCF system, not just our Medicaid patients, but other patients. We really care deeply about how these kids get services, where they're located, and then how we get them back engaged in society in a healthy way. So whatever we can do, I appeal to my friends in the legislature and to others. We need to make this an urgent matter that we address.
Michael, it's good to see you. Thank you for your time, as always. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Michael.
Always. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Michael Curry, the president and CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers. He's also a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors, where he chairs the board's Advocacy and Policy Committee. Coming up, GBH News analyst and Ground Truth Project's editor-in-chief, Charlie Sennett, on the Syria-Turkey earthquake tragedy and what he thinks is flying in the skies over North America, whether he's seen E.T. or not. We'll get Charlie Sennett's take when we return. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
I'm Jim Browdy, head on Boston Public Radio. After talking about it with listeners earlier in the show, we'll discuss the Chinese spy balloon and those three other unidentified objects in 3 days with GBH News analyst Charlie Sennett. What do we know, and should we be concerned? Plus, relief efforts in Turkey and Syria are two very different things.
The Supreme Court weighs an ethics code, finally. We'll speak with retired federal judge Nancy Gertner about this and whether a Manhattan prosecutor has ruined the case against Donald Trump and his alleged financial misdeeds. Then the Reverends Ian Monroe and Emmett Price delve into the Super Bowl, why Emmett doesn't watch football anymore, and the alarming views of so-called white nationalists. All that ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. The following is a rebroadcast of the program that was aired earlier today.
Houston Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to hour number 2 of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. Tomorrow we're at the library and ask the mayor with Mayor Wu. She'll be there with us 11 to 12. Ask the Attorney General, the first of monthly appearances from the new Attorney General, Andrea Campbell. That's from 1 to 2. We're joined now on Zoom by Charlie Sennett, GBH News Analyst, Ground Truth Project's Editor-in-Chief. Hopefully he can explain what the hell's going on in our skies, as government officials have confirmed they've shot down three unidentified objects in 3 days. As we mentioned, you know, the United Air Force General, his head of NORAD, Glenn Van Herk, whose task was safeguarding U.S. airspace, told reporters he would not rule out, you know, aliens. In any case, Charlie, welcome. He's laughing, too. I mean, Charlie, welcome to the show. How are you?
This
is a sad discussion.
It is. We shouldn't be taking glee and
I agree,
flying
exactly.
over our skies okay. being shut down
or
by
whatever
our military.
It is.
But it is hard to know what the heck is going on.
Do you think I know this is speculation.
Yeah.
Do you think our government knows as little as they suggest they know about these three objects?
No. I think they know more. Yeah. But I also think that what we're seeing is, look, the spy balloon was quite a big overinflated, we might say, issue, but one that needed to be addressed. And then Biden did address it. And I think, you know, got criticized by the Republicans for not doing it quickly enough, not protecting our skies, praised by people who felt like he did wait for the right moment when it was out over the ocean and no one could get hurt by taking the thing down, and that he did respond. And as he's pointed out, these balloons have been in our skies all through the Trump presidency and no one did anything. So the question is, what are these balloons? They're clearly not, as the Pentagon now tells us, related to weather surveillance. This is surveillance. So remember, this whole thing begins 9 days ago, or maybe it was 10 days ago, with that first balloon being taken down, the so-called spy balloon, right? That was from China. We know that. Now, these other three, what we know is very little. We don't know what they were. They're unidentified flying objects described as some places as cylindrically shaped. That's about the Ooh. Most information we have. And
cylindrically
I think,
shaped.
Yeah, right. And even today, the Pentagon wouldn't comment on the shape.
Do they go backwards and forwards and stay in space? I mean, can they turn circles 360 degrees?
But what we know is like
Thank
after
you for
the,
ignoring
after
her question,
spy,
Charlie. Go ahead, continue.
Well, after the spy balloon, we really stepped up the surveillance in the skies. They tweaked their radars to be much more observant. And so the question I have is, Does that just mean that when you turn up, you know, all of the radars, you start to pick up everything that is in the sky, including...
Wait a second. You don't believe that. You think they all of a sudden, after the Chinese spy balloon, all of a sudden they turned up our sensors, and that's why they're noticing? I mean...
Yeah, I think they're... I do.
Yeah, what? There
yeah,
you go.
Why not? I mean, they're hyper-vigilant right now because they want to figure out what's going on. It's become a political issue for the Biden administration. And yeah, I'm sure that in some cabinet briefing, they said, let's get all over this. Let's figure out what the heck is going on. What was that thing? How many others could there be? We need to know. And when you do that and you get hyper-vigilant, you start to over-report things, right? And you might actually take out an Amazon drone. Who
overshoot.
Knows?
Have, yeah, you might exactly. overshoot,
I have
too.
No idea what those things were. But I think more than likely, there probably is... you know, in our skies, there probably are governments that are trying to monitor. It's not inconceivable. That's what China was doing. We know that. And there's going to be more information that comes out on it. Look, we're protecting our skies. I get it. It's just impossible to know the details.
Listen, I think in the next few days, the word is watch out, E.T.
Okay, here you go.
Just watch out.
Can we go back to the China spy balloon?
Come home, E.T.
You know, yeah, go home and come back later. That's what I would say.
You know what I'm having a real problem with, too? And I've tried to watch or read almost everything I can. I find it hard to believe that I was going to say if China's spying on us. Obviously, China's spying on us, and we're spying on them. And Russia's spying on us, and we're spying
on
them.
But the bigger...
They do it with a balloon? They do it with a balloon?
Yeah, they do it with a balloon.
No, I'm serious.
Well, look, honestly, truly... Good question, Jim. I appreciate your exasperation and cynicism. But I'd also say they do spy on us every day through TikTok.
Well,
and in ways that are much more woven into our lives than a spy balloon. But come on, the spy balloon. First of all, did you see the Saturday Night Live skit about the spy balloon?
No,
I didn't think it was funny.
Was it funny?
Actually, I did see
you
it.
Did?
I
didn't
really?
Think it was funny. I mean, the guy in the ocean, the guy like bouncing back
yeah,
and forth.
Yeah, that was good.
I didn't think it was that fun.
All right, anyway. look, this is even though it's hard for us to contain our smirks here, this is serious business. This is about government spying on our
Wait,
country.
This is such serious business. Marjorie's talking about being beamed up and probed, and Charlie Sennett, foreign correspondent extraordinaire,
I'm trying to be serious,
editor-in-chief of Ground Truth, is asking me if I saw SNL. I mean, yeah, that's
all right. Fair
we're
enough.
Having a real
hey, fair enough, Jim. But I am trying to be a responsible news analyst here
okay.
and actually take an assessment of how much spying is going on in the air over our country. We should care about that. Truly,
I totally agree with that. And all I would like, and I understand, you know, it's one thing that they don't tell us what's going on, sort of under the radar, literally and figuratively. I understand that. But when something becomes a public issue like this, they have an obligation to not totally leave us in the dark. I understand there's some things yep. they have to keep to themselves, but you got to be a fool to think we know as little about this, in my estimation, as little about this as is suggested by our government. We're talking to Charlie Sennett from the Ground Truth Project.
Okay, well, let's move from something that's,
well,
that
just,
we can...
just before we move on,
sure.
Truthfully, the thing is, if we overreacted to this spy balloon and shot it down, and our relations with China are under deep stress, this is the serious part of what this thing means politically. And that is, look, we don't have great relations with China right now. It's very tense, and China is still considering itself aligned with Russia. We need to pull China to our side. When Blinken canceled his trip to China, that
Secretary of State Blinken, for those who are
Secretary yeah. of State Blinken yeah. canceled his trip to China. I think that was a mistake. I mean, we have serious issues to talk about, including the war in Ukraine and climate change and other really important topics. And what's something to watch and is fraught and meaningful is, look, we took down that spy balloon right now. Imagine if there is a much more serious event, something that is real, that is maybe North Korea with nuclear weapons, or that is China with developing a program that we don't like, or something that becomes much more escalated and isn't just inflated.
You know, so to speak, enough with the puns. Can I
ask right,
what? No, no, no. But I want to stay on this for a second, if I can.
Okay.
I didn't know we were going to go into this level. But, you know, one of the things that's interesting to me, and maybe my sense of their response is represents a lack of understanding, but you know this stuff cold. I thought China's response was incredibly muted, just shooting down. I mean, I know if there was an objective person, which there isn't, you'd say, well, over our airspace, we have a right. I mean, it's not about the right. A lot of things we have a right to. Didn't you think their response was muted, Charlie Sennett?
Yeah, I think it's a good observation. There was a sense that there were a lot of diplomatic channels and cables going back and forth telling them we're taking this thing down. And the caution, yeah, the pause, the time that the Biden administration took to have our military take this down was indeed thoughtful and cautious and slow. And that, of course, has aggravated the Republicans. But I think it was the right way to go. You're right. We've spent too much time on this. There's really important stuff. And I know you have there is other important business you have to do today. So let's go quickly through some really important other things happening in the world.
Yeah, well,
the
tragedy that's just getting worse and worse every day. I think we're up over 30,000 people now.
36 or 37, yeah.
In the earthquake and the Turkey of Syria border. Allegations of Turkey not building buildings they should have to withstand earthquakes. Allegation the Syrians preventing aid from getting in. So bring us up to date, Charlie.
Yeah, the piece in the New York Times today, lead story in the front page about how President Erdogan had been granting amnesty to developers to build buildings without going up fully to the codes that were recommended in a very earthquake-prone part of the world. He did that because Erdogan is largely supported by the real estate industry, to whom he has been quite kind, and they love him, and it has everything to do with his political success. It's interesting, he faces a big election in mid-May, and it's interesting that this issue is not only an enormous tragedy, it is hard to fathom the death and the destruction and just the way people are, you know, out in the freezing cold, and the rescue efforts are so noble and somehow they feel so futile, and you just can't help but have your heart break. But this is also a political issue now for Erdogan, and a big one, because he is the one who relaxed these measures, allowed the building boom to happen. And there are a lot of these properties that were built by those to whom he gave this amnesty around the building. And so those contractors, some of them have been arrested. I think there are more than 100 arrests, yeah, that have been made, including people who were at the airport with lots of cash leaving the country. And that is a very interesting piece of this that it of course is small in comparison to the enormity of the human loss and the tragedy, but it is a political equation that's important.
You know, we got to take a break. Can we stay on this? Because I want to ask you about what we're going to do about Syria. I was too unaware, I guess, of how difficult it is to get any relief and supplies into Syria, and that Russia has a role in that difficulty. Yeah. Let's talk about that when we return.
Yeah, we're going to be right back. We're going to talk some more with Charlie Sennett, Jim just said, about Russia's involvement in the Syria relief or not relief to victims of this earthquake and what's going on in Ukraine. You're listening to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
By the way, because Marjorie's so unprofessional, let me just repeat again. It's gbhnews.org is the alternative,
yes,
way to make contributions.
It is.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio with Marjorie Egan and me, Jim Browdy. We're speaking with GBH News analyst Charlie Sennett.
So, Charlie, before the break, we were talking about Erdogan. How do you say his name?
Erdogan.
Erdogan, excuse me. The president of Turkey allowing developers to build buildings that weren't up to code. I mean, California, that's a classic example, right? So many of these buildings out there survive these incredibly large earthquakes because they're built to survive these incredibly large earthquakes. So you talked about that. But there's also a difficulty getting aid into Syria, which has been in the middle of a civil war for many years now. So what's happening on the Syrian side?
Well, I mean, the tragedy on the Syrian side is a tragedy inside of a tragic war, right? So you have a war unfolding where people have suffered so much loss. There's so much destruction from the relentless war that has gone on there. And now can you imagine this devastating earthquake on top of that? So it sounds like, I mean, the New York Times death tolls are, it's interesting to me, they're significantly higher than AP. I think there's still a lot of work to do to figure out what is the real death toll. We know it's enormous. We know the scope of this tragedy is almost unfathomable. But the New York Times is reporting death toll rising, 29,000 killed in Turkey and more than 3,500 in Syria. But the death toll in Syria is really rising because those are harder numbers to count. It's harder for any ground truth in there to know what's really going on, to really be there and be able to assess. But we know that more than 1 million people have been displaced. And most of those displaced in Syria are living in places where so many are already displaced and living in camps and in refugee camps and the war. So it's just a, as I say, tragedy heaped on top of a tragedy amid the rubble of all of these failings, political and otherwise, that have allowed this shoddy construction to happen and this war to unfold. But there we are. And I think one of the issues that's really interesting is on the border, where they're trying to get aid from, you know, to come into Syria. So we have al-Assad, the president who's led the war, is controlling this area in northern
Northwest Syria.
Southern Turkey and northern Syria. That area by Bashar al-Assad's control is so corrupt. All of his cronies will take that aid. And that is what aid workers fear, and they're trying to figure it out. So it's a really tough one. If we have a minute, it's also worth looking at some of the reasons for this, the tectonic plates. Why is this such a prone area to earthquakes? But I don't know if we have time, and I know you guys have to be able to break. So
no,
I'll
but,
stop.
Yeah, but can I say one thing about that? I understand. I don't know anything about the science, and you should feel free in a minute to talk about it. But I was saying to Marjorie before we went on the air, I've seen photos, and I'm sure you have too, in downtown major cities in Turkey where there's horrible devastation. And right next to the total collapse of an apartment building is a building that is standing perfectly, which suggests that some build the code and obey the law and some don't build the code, tectonic plates or not, right?
Exactly. One of the most, I thought, powerful photographs was that aerial shot. This might be the one.
Yes.
Devastation. And then the hospital.
Oh, that's right. No, I wasn't thinking of that, but I have seen it. Yeah.
And that hospital, obviously, was built to code.
Yep.
Everything around it is destroyed. And when I looked at that, I thought, if I were there on the ground as a reporter or an aid worker who's there on the ground, I just looked at that and thought, how do you get to the hospital? It's complete rubble. Like, how would you possibly walk over that? And you certainly won't be able to drive. And so that image for me sort of captured some of that. But the tectonic plates interest me because they're an incredible metaphor for that part of the world. I don't want to get too metaphorical when there's so much real tragedy on the ground. But what happens with the tectonic plates in Turkey and in Syria is that they're, both countries are on a fault line between the Arabian Peninsula and the Eurasian Plate. I'm not a geologist for sure, but I have always been intrigued by that line, because in 1999, I covered a terrible earthquake there. Thousands were killed in Izmit. And that was when I began to talk to people about those fault lines. How do they form along the Anatolian faults? There's one in the north and there's one in the east. If I have my geography right, and I may not, but I think I do, I think this one cuts along the East Anatolian fault. And Turkey is a place that is literally caught between the Middle East and Europe.
Yeah.
And it's forged and under pressure. And what it yields, and what it yielded in Syria with a war, and what it yields in Turkey with a rising movement toward a much more traditional interpretation of Islam, Islamic fundamentalism. A lot of those mosques are funded by Saudis, and that's pushing up into Turkey. It really just interests me that this fault line, this physical geological fault line of an earthquake, also has a political metaphor and reflection to it that is also an incredible fault line. And if you think about that series, I don't know if you remember, a long time ago, we did a series with GBH on the 100th anniversary of World War One.
Of course we do. Yeah.
And those lines that were drawn after World War One, just like you know, by Sykes and Pico on a piece of paper. And they ignored things like this incredible geography and the tensions that happen all along it. And I think we're seeing the tragedy of the war in Syria, now the tragedy of the earthquake. They cut right along that fault line.
You know what I was also thinking, Charlie Sennett, is how lucky, we forget how lucky we are to be Americans. You know, you're reading these stories about they are finding these miracles of children alive and other people alive, but they don't have the equipment, as we said, how do you get to the hospital? You know, you think if this happens in the United States of America, you have firefighters and EMTs and people descending from all over the place with helicopters and the most sophisticated machinery in there, finding sometimes people alive, and then they're so severely injured they can't get them the help. There's no place to take them. And they're, I mean, we forget, I think.
No, it's a great, great observation, Marjorie. And it's also really true that our country and Syria and Turkey, the heroes come out.
Yeah.
So we saw in 9/11 the incredible heroism of police officers who went into the fire, firemen who went in, first responders who were there trying to do their rescues. We remember, if we just think back those 20 plus years ago, on the heroism in our country dealing with a much smaller scale tragedy in many ways. And we think about the enormity of that tragedy there. And I just want to do a shout out to an organization I've seen and admired from afar for a very long time. I don't know if you've heard about the White Helmets, the people inside Syria who respond to the rubble of the war and save people. These guys are heroic. There's a documentary about them. They are also back out there now. It used to be digging through the rubble of the bombing from the war in Syria. Now they're digging through the rubble of the earthquake on top of the rubble of the war. And heroes are in every country, and they always seem to come in the form of first responders. So, yeah, Marjorie, I agree. What a moment to just reflect how lucky we are, but how we also share the basic first responders need to be heroes. And we're seeing that all over the place in Syria and in Turkey.
Charlie, thanks so much for your insight into all this. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks, Marjorie.
We've been speaking with GBH News analyst Charlie Sennett. He's also editor-in-chief at the Ground Truth Project. Coming up next, retired federal judge Nancy Gertner on whether the Supreme Court needs an ethics watchdog and whether a former federal prosecutor, or I should say Manhattan prosecutor, is ruining the case against Donald Trump and his financial alleged misdeeds. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Reminder, we're at the library tomorrow. With us from 11 to 12 is Michelle Wu. Ask the mayor. You can call her and ask a question. You can text the question. You can show up at the library and ask a question eyeball to eyeball. And then 1 to 2, our first, ask the attorney general with the new attorney general, Andrea Campbell. Same deal with her. She'll answer your questions by phone, by text, or in person. We hope you join us. Now for another edition of On the Docket, we're joined by, on Zoom by Nancy Gertner. The Judge Gertner is a retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and a BPR contributor. Judge Gertner, it's good to see you.
Good to be here.
Well, Judge Gertner, thank you so much for joining us. So the former Manhattan prosecutor Mark Pomerantz has been all over the airwaves this weekend talking about his new book about the investigation he was involved in, looking into former President Trump's financial dealings. The new DA came in, Alvin Bragg, and said the case wasn't ready and delayed the case. There's now investigations are going again. But there's concern that this Pomerantz character may be jeopardizing the investigation into Trump, his financial dealings, as well as the alleged hush money given to Stormy Daniels, the former porn star. Maybe she still is a porn star. I don't know. But she has been. She has been a porn star.
I'll put that on my to-do list to find out.
Okay. So has he possibly ruined the case?
I don't know about totally ruin it, but it's all I kept on thinking when I read the coverage is that this was the victory of narcissism over judgment. You remember the controversy over Jim Comey when he came out with the decision, you know, sort of describing why he chose not to prosecute Hillary before the election and then reopening the investigation. There is an extraordinary sensitivity to prosecution memos. Because if they choose not to indict, or even if they choose to indict, the contents of those memos are not intended to be seen or heard by a jury. And so essentially this was one long prosecution memo that Pomerantz brought, which includes information that could taint a future jury pool, which could make it very difficult to try Trump. Now, the difficulty here, of course, is, I mean, he may think that this is already embedded in the January 6th committee report. In other words, that horse is out of the barn already. But still, he's really added fuel to the fire here. I mean, I found it extraordinary and incredibly irresponsible for a prosecutor to say, here's the evidence I amassed against X. And my superiors didn't want to bring charges. Yeah. I mean, that is unbelievably prejudicial.
Well, not prejudicial, and I can't believe I'm saying this, really unfair to a potential defendant, in this case, Donald Trump, and for whatever it's worth. Speaking of that, I know you're sick, Judge Gardner, of me asking the same question every time I see you. What is taking so long? Either indict or say there's not a factual basis for indictment, the latest thing that I assume could lead to interminable delay, you'll tell us what you think, is the decision by Jack Smith, the special counsel, to subpoena the former Vice President, Mike Pence. It's unclear if he's going to obey the subpoena. What's going on?
Well, to some degree, the Pence subpoena suggests the ending of an investigation, because usually the prosecutors start from the bottom and move up. So the going to Pence signals, an advance in the investigation and maybe the ending of this investigation. Yes, Pence is going to we don't know for sure, but Pence could wrap up this part of the investigation for a long time. They may have to make a decision whether they go forward without Pence's participation. It could wrap them up. But at least in the coverage this weekend, they understand that they have maybe another month or two, to bring charges before this gets wrapped up in
the midterm, the next elections. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I hate to put it this way, but the end is near because it has to be near.
You know, it seems to me, though, that first of all, it's unclear, correct me if I'm wrong, as to whether or not Pence would comply. And I assume they're not going to litigate this, because if they litigate it, then they're going to miss those informal deadlines by forever. It seems to me he could either support and advance the whole thing big time if he's willing to say that Trump wanted him to cook the books, as I believe he did, but that he said it directly to his face. Or if he says what he said in other places, all he was doing, in my estimation, was listening to bad advice from his lawyers. He didn't do anything wrong. He was just following the lead of either incompetent or misguided lawyers. Pence could really be the linchpin for everything here if he does testify, no?
Absolutely. No, but the question is, Pence would be asked what his conversations were with Trump with respect to the false elector scheme, that or the delay of the certification. And he certainly, all he has to do, though, is to say, Trump said, accept these false electors and I'll take care of everything else, because they will already have testimony that the electors were false and that he knew that the scheme was illegal. In other words, Pence doesn't have to deliver the entire story. He only has to deliver the end of the story, and they have pieces from other quarters. Pence could arguably, raise, as likely raise, executive privilege. And as the executive privilege actually does not work with respect to a criminal prosecution, it worked more. I don't even think it should have worked as much with respect to a congressional committee, because this is a congressional committee investigating the executive. But with respect to the DOJ investigating criminal activities by the former president, I don't believe he has much of an executive privilege argument. I think that that would only be a delay tactic.
Can you explain? Don't leave that. Could you explain that for a second? Are you saying that even if executive privilege would otherwise apply, it doesn't apply if the underlying thing that led to the declaration of executive privilege is in furtherance of criminal activity? Is that what you're saying?
Right. The framework here is that there are lots of privileges, like the attorney-client privilege, arguably even the executive privilege, which if the executive privilege is used not to protect presidential deliberations, which is what is intended to, but was intended to facilitate a crime, that would be very different. And even Nixon did not claim that. And if there's a criminal investigation and they're saying that the deliberations between Pence and Trump were part of the facilitation of the crime of interfering with the election, then I don't think executive privilege would apply. Could he raise the issue in court and tie this up for a while? Yes. Alternatively, if he really wants to run for president, he may want to deliver the final blow to Trump.
You know, Nancy Gardner, one last thing before we take a quick break and then move on to our favorite topic, lack of ethics or lack of same on the Supreme Court of the United States. Let's assume that this informal month or two deadline is adhered to by everybody involved. Trump is indicted in Georgia for that infamous phone call to the Secretary of State and things that come with it. Trump is indicted by the U.S. of the Attorney General and upon recommendations from the special counsel on two things. He's indicted by the Manhattan District Attorney for these hush payments in violation of campaign finance law to Stormy Daniels. How is it determined who goes first?
It isn't. I mean, presumably they could informally get together to determine who goes first, but they can do this in any order that they want. So this would be a question of an informal behind the scenes, you go first kind of thing.
Is that how it works? I mean, I understand there's a lot of ego invested in these kinds of things too. Would the three prosecutors involved in Georgia, in Manhattan, and in the Attorney General's office, hopefully like grown-ups, say this is the strongest case of the four, assuming there are four, and as a result, you should go first? Would that?
They certainly could do that. This is not unusual, for example, to have federal and state prosecutions, and we're essentially both prosecutors get together and say, you go first. But they're not bound by that, and they're not bound by that. One would think that they should, but they're not bound by it.
We're talking with retired federal judge Nancy Gertner. We're going to keep talking with her after this quick break. You're listening to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're continuing our conversation with the retired federal judge, now at Harvard Law School, Nancy Gertner.
So, Judge Gertner, a lot of us were very upset when Clarence Thomas didn't recuse himself from decisions involving the January 6th insurrection because his wife was very much involved in pushing these kind of conspiracy theories about the election texts and that sort of thing. Then we learned, and some of us, I was very surprised by this, but that the Chief Justice, the one who's supposedly so concerned about the integrity and the reputation of the court, his wife, who used to be in a law firm, left the law firm and became one of these kind of recruiters. And what she do is hire lawyers to law firms that had business before the court, which and made millions of dollars doing it. It seems like a blatant conflict of interest. So now more and more people are saying we need some kind of ethics code. We've talked to you about this before, but what would this ethics code mean? And I also wonder, just historically, I think this is unusual to have this much ethical doubt swirling around the Supreme Court. Although maybe I'm wrong. Maybe we did way back when, but I don't know.
I think there have been ethical issues surrounding the Supreme Court on other occasions. If you remember, Abe Fortas was actually forced to resign.
That's right. With Johnson? Was he Johnson?
Right. Yeah. So I mean, this is not unusual. And the question of what's the code of ethics for Supreme Court justices has been, you know, hanging fire for numbers of years. There are two issues. What should the code consist of? Bearing in mind that the Supreme Court is different than other courts, which is that, you know, disqualifying one judge in a 9-judge court has a different resonance than disqualifying one judge in a district court, which yeah. has many more justices. So there are certainly different issues, but the question of what the content of the code of conduct should be, and then the question of who enforces it, are two separate questions. If the content of the code of conduct, they have been promising, the Supreme Court has been promising since 2019 to come up with their own code of conduct that would be unique to the institutional needs of the Supreme Court, and they still have not. Then the question of who should enforce it, right? The difficulty, as I've said on other occasions, is we have the most powerful Supreme Court in the world. And so Congress can't enforce a code of conduct against the justices. Congress can impeach, but anything short of that, they can't do, because that raises separation of powers issue, Congress telling the Supreme Court what to do. There could be a panel of justices on the Supreme Court, a sort of a subcommittee, which raises questions about the, you know, the Supreme Court then standing in judgment of their own members. And then there are proposals to have circuit court judges, a subcommittee of a circuit court judges to sit in judgment on the Supreme Court. And that has its own awkwardness. All of these things, in my judgment, can be resolved and can be resolved constitutionally, but need to be resolved.
You know, I've said this before on the air, but I have to say it again. The Clarence Thomas thing doesn't surprise me. I think it's what you'd expect from Clarence and Ginny Thomas. As Marjorie said, this is a Chief Justice who keeps talking about the legitimacy of the court. You wrote it. We should mention the piece you wrote about
yes.
him at the, in a minute. But I want to repeat what she said. His wife, as a headhunter, is making millions of dollars by placing lawyers at law firms that appear before her husband. His wife is bringing home millions of dollars to their household from placing people who will have cases before her husband. How much clearer could this be? And then, to get me more aggravated, I'm reading a story, I think it was the New York Times. At a 2019 budget hearing before a House committee, Justice Elena Kagan said the Chief Justice, Roberts, is, quote, studying the question of whether to have a code of judicial conduct that's applicable only to the Supreme Court. That's something we have not discussed as a conference yet, and that has its pros and cons. You know what worries me about this, and feel free, because I know you know her, to disabuse me of this. I think Kagan and Sotomayor were for cameras in the courtroom until they got to the Supreme Court, and now they have doubts about cameras in the courtroom. When Elena Kagan, who is a woman, at least as far as I know, of great integrity, it has pros and cons. What is the con of having a set of standards, ethical standards, and having them enforced? What is the con, Judge Gertner?
I can't think of a con with respect to coming up with ethical standards, period. You know, what comprises, there's a statute that forces, that requires recusal when you have an interest in the outcome or where there's an appearance of impartial, mm-hmm. of partiality. The problem is how to enforce that against the Supreme Court. that they, and I think that they should come up with a proposal if they think that this is an issue, and that and there, it could be a subcommittee of court of judges who of other judges, and they agree to be bound by it.
Well, can I tell you something, my man? You may not like this in light of what you just said. One of the ways to work out a compromise is make it so they're not even bound by it. Let a panel of respected jurists rule that Clarence Thomas or John Roberts or Jane Doe on the Supreme Court has violated ethical standards, and let them decide to not comply with a voluntarily recommended sanction. I think that would do the trick, but something has got to
Well, you know, I mean, if you're saying there has to be a statement somewhere that you've done wrong.
Yes, exactly.
It can't just be, you know, CNN or WGBH. It has to be an official statement that this is wrong by which to measure their conduct. I think that that's right. Clarence Thomas and Ginni Thomas are one situation. We've talked about that before. Ginni Thomas is literally funding amicus briefs that appear in cases in front of Clarence Thomas, and Ginni Thomas's text were in the materials that went to that were before Clarence Thomas on some of the Trump records cases,
where he was the only vote where he was the only vote of nine not to turn over those that information in the January 6th committee.
And aren't some of these amicus briefs, Judge, quoted in the Supreme Court justices' decisions?
Right. I mean, I every time I've been on this subject, I struggled with this because, as I have said 9 million times, my husband was the legal director of the ACLU when I was on the bench. So the question is, what was he doing that crossed into my court? What was that? That was the boundary. If you crossed into my court with an amicus or the ACLU took a position, that was out of the question. So the Clarence Thomas stuff is crossing into the Supreme Court. The issues with respect to Justice Roberts' wife are slightly different. That's more about conflicts of interest. That's more about influence peddling. That's more about she is cashing in on being the wife of the of the Chief Justice of the court. And that's a kind of influence peddling which is very difficult to address. That's very difficult to address because that's the case for probably the relatives of every Supreme Court justice. You know, any of Elena Kagan's siblings or you know, relatives would probably talk about their proximity to her as a way of getting business. That's just a much more difficult kind of thing because there's influence peddling. You know, anyone close to any judge will say, you know, I used to have this all the time. Someone will talk about their closeness to me and getting a reservation for something or other. And
I've used your name in a couple of restaurants, Judge Gerner. I want you to know.
But I guess
immediately, but influence peddling is a very different. It's not a very different issue. It's related, but it certainly is not the same thing as I'm actually going to be ruling on my wife's texts, or I'm actually going to be adopting this amicus brief that my wife has funded.
But doesn't the millions of dollars make it a little more blatant?
Well, think about how you would have to stop that, Marjorie, and particularly, actually, let's roll back the clock. There used to be a time when the Supreme Court was all men, most of the bench was men, and most of their wives did not work.
Correct.
Right? Now we have both women on the bench whose husbands work, and we have men on the bench whose wives work. And you have to say, how do I deal with the work of the husband, of the spouses, and how that relates to the judicial function, and what are the kind of lines we can draw? I think that that's actually a difficult line to draw. That she's capitalizing on her husband's, you know, husband's position is clear, but how would you define it? Right, that she can't be. She's apparently resigned as a lawyer.
Wait a second, but
your
Nancy Gerner, you're only looking at one. I'm sorry.
Certain, I was going to say your clients would have to be certain clients. You could continue being a lawyer, but your job would be circumcised somewhat by your husband.
Circumscribed, not circumcised.
Excuse me.
Even though it probably should be in some cases.
Circumscribed by your husband's job to a certain degree, but you wouldn't be barred from practicing law. You could represent somebody or some public interest.
No, but her comment is that she resigned. She resigned as a lawyer so that this wouldn't be an issue. And what she does is that she's a recruiter. And the articles say she helps recruit firms, some of which had business before the Supreme Court.
Yeah, but if I may, we only have 1 minute left. With all due respect, it seems to me you're only looking from one side of this. The non-court spouse and, you know, capitalizing financially or otherwise on who you happen to be related to. How about the compromise of the integrity, or at least the appearance of it, of the justice who's ruling on a damn case? You know, forget whatever Roberts's wife's first name is. How trusting can one be, confident in the impartiality of the justice whose family is benefiting from these millions of dollars in fees?
Well, but it's not. But Jim, it's a complicated benefit. So it's not the case. She recruits for firms. Some of the firms, not all of them.
Correct.
Have business before the Supreme Court.
That's true.
Some of the lawyers in those firms that have business before the Supreme Court may be people that she has recruited to work at the firm. Will Roberts look more kindly on them if he knows that they're the people that she recruited? Well, is there a difference between that and all of the former law clerks that are regularly before the Supreme Court that the justices know?
That's a good point.
I mean, I think this is a much more difficult question because she's not directly as a lawyer. She is indirectly as a recruiter and making millions of dollars off of her closeness to him. You could probably go down the list of lots of judges who are in that situation.
You're far too fair. I hate to criticize you.
Sorry.
Really yeah. Unacceptable in this show.
Okay.
Judge.
Yeah, but I mean, do I deserve a smug mug now?
No. For $150, you can deserve. For $300, you deserve two smug mugs. By the way, the number is 888-897-9424 if you'd like to purchase a smug mug.
Judge Gertner, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Good to see you.
We've been speaking with retired federal judge Nancy Gertner. She's a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and a Boston Public Radio contributor. Coming up, all revved up, the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. Join us next. You're listening to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Trusted. Local. News. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, HD1 Boston, online at gbhnews.org. GBH News with NPR. What matters to you.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan, Jim Browdy. It's time now for All Revved Up on Boston Public Radio with Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. Reverend Monroe is a syndicated religion columnist, the Boston's voice for Detour's African American Heritage Trail. Reverend Price is the founding pastor of the Community of Love Christian Fellowship in Alston, the inaugural dean of Africana Studies at Berklee College of Music. And together, of course, they host GBH's All Revved Up podcast. Good afternoon to both of you.
Thanks for having
us
back.
Good afternoon.
Our pleasure.
Post Super Bowl Sunday.
Emmett does know what we're talking about, of course.
I thought about you, Emmett Price,
so did
about
I.
50 times
so did
yesterday,
I.
Thinking, here I am soaking it all in, pregame show, Chris Stapleton, you know, the Ben Affleck, Dunkin' Donuts
He missed
commercial.
A performance with Rihanna. You missed a performance.
I cheated. I did not watch the game. But I did check out the Rihanna performance, and I did check out the Star Spangled Banner.
Oh, my.
Wasn't Stapleton incredible?
Very, okay. Very powerful. Very powerful.
For one of the hardest songs to sing, people say. Yeah. It was really, really beautiful.
Yeah. And Cheryl Lee Ralph, too, because Lift Every Voice and Sing is very difficult. It's a difficult one, too.
Yeah.
It was beautiful.
I have a question for you two or reverends. Now, Rihanna pregnant, we saw the first pregnant Super Bowl performance, and that was great. But I thought we should have seen more of those bodies, her body and everybody else's body. You know what I mean? They were all covered up. They looked like they're a bunch of nuns out there in the habits. I mean, what did you think
about
that?
Well, she's pregnant again. You know, she's pregnant again. This is what she revealed this morning on the radio. So, you know, she's kind of, you know, covering up for that reason alone. But it was a good family show, I have to say.
Hey, Emma, do you mind before we go back? We've mentioned on many occasions that you are not watching pro football, even though you love the game, in the abstract at least. Could you, we haven't said probably in a year or so why you make that choice. Can you share that with people for a minute, if you would?
Absolutely. Back in probably 2013, I think it was, when Colin Kaepernick was unjustly scrutinized for his protest of, you know, the issues surrounding police brutality and what led to Black Lives Matter. Many of us chose to boycott the NFL because of their stance on that. And I've just decided to not go back. Kaepernick is still not playing in the NFL. And so, you know, I don't know if he gets a job, will I go back? But I don't miss it. I tell you that. I do not miss it.
Okay, but it's a decade later, and there have been some incremental changes here. So I do invite you, Emmett, to not so much rethink watching it, but to at least applaud and recognize some of the changes that have been made.
Well, can I,
I'm
can
of
I,
an era when sorry. I would never expect two quarterbacks. I'm of the, I have to say, O.J. Simpson moment, you know, where he was the only football player of the moment chasing a Hertz commercial.
Well, yeah. You know, I have to say, I guess that's progress for, and I guess at least the teams deserve credit, except you don't really deserve credit when the deed for which you're getting credit is you recognize the most talented person should be the leader of your effort. But I have to say, I'm surprised to hear you say that, Irene, because I think 90% of the, quote, progress the NFL makes is papered over BS.
Yes.
You know, hiring Jay-Z, who I think was used, maybe willingly, to do this. You know, they sing the Black National Anthem kind of thing. But look at high places, executive positions, coaches. I mean, it's still a league that is happy to benefit based on the athletic prowess of players.
It's a slaveocracy. It's a slaveocracy.
Well, and I'm trying to be optimistic with the little incremental changes that are being made, being hopeful now that we will see more of that kind of systemic change that we're talking about. It's not so much as much as a slaveocracy, but because I think that is a little too drastic in terms of demeans the players and the expertise and the work that they put into it. But it is an exploitation that we cannot dismiss.
Do you have a consulting contract with Roger Goodell? What happened to you?
No, it's just that a number of my friends, their children are going in, being, you know, recruited by the NFL, and they're giving me a different kind of backstory, you know, about it. It told me not to be so harsh.
Okay.
Well, one thing I wonder, I heard this interview with Doug Williams, who was the first Black quarterback in the Super Bowl, and he was talking
to win
about
the Super Bowl,
right? That his athleticism was never questioned. It was always a question of whether he had the leadership, whether white guys would follow him, or whether he had a big enough brain to read the field and all this kind of stuff. So, to me, and I could be totally wrong, but you know, I think all you thought of when you watch Mahomes and Jalen Hurts, who I'd never really watched because I don't really watch football.
Yeah,
and
really.
You think, this guy is just a super. He can do everything. He reads the field. He reads, you know, the plays. He's running. He's throwing. So I don't know. Maybe that's just silly. But
I don't think it's silly, Marjorie. And I think, you know, to Irene's point, some people understand football as religion. And some people are unwilling to give it up, regardless of what, you know, the atrocities or whatnot. And I think that that's a cultural hold on folks. I absolutely respect the historic moment of having two Black quarterbacks. I do remember the day when folks said that Black quarterbacks were not smart enough to lure teams.
Right.
You
that's
just mentioned
right.
Marjorie. So I do see that as progress. However, it's just not enough for me. So I'm glad that Irene is back in the NFL camp and stumping for Roger Goodell.
Okay.
I think what happens is that when you don't see the little changes that come, that when the big ones come, you can't appreciate it. So I'm the optimistic one, hoping very much for the kind of change. And it's not about getting Emmett back to watch. It's just that I'm hoping that with a younger generation, I am beginning, you know, you live long enough as listen, as Jim, Marjorie and I, you do begin to see how the cogs in the wheel begin to turn.
Does anybody know, by the way, why Elon Musk was sitting next to Rupert Murdoch yesterday? Do we know,
I wonder why. Two right-wing people in the media who are billionaires. I wonder why they'd sit together.
I don't know. I just thought that was an odd pairing, but maybe.
I don't think it was odd at all.
I didn't see him.
Hey,
I'm glad I didn't.
We know Emmett didn't see him, that's for sure. So every time I'm about to start a sentence by saying, I was really surprised when I'm talking to the two of you, I realized I have to withdraw that. So I guess I shouldn't have been surprised. The headline is, what is Black History Month in a white Christian nation? It's this Brookings PRRI survey. These numbers are, first of all, for those who don't know, people, roughly a third of the population in this country, a third, are either avowed Christian nationalists or people who are very sympathetic, they say in polls. That's almost a third of the population. Listen to some of these numbers. Just over 80% of white Americans who strongly embrace Christian nationalism disagree that generations of slavery and discrimination make for an uneven playing field for black Americans, compared with 45% of all Americans. Listen to this one. 85% of white Americans who strongly embrace Christian nationalism believe discrimination against white Americans is as big a problem as discrimination against black Americans and other people of color, compared with 41% of all Americans. Is there anything about this, Emmett, that surprises you?
No, not at all. No. Not at all, Jim. And, you know, and I've made my mind up a couple of years ago that I will no longer debate against foolishness. And you know, I used to be a staunch opponent of trying to convince white folks, particularly white evangelicals, of the historical misgivings and even trying to appease the fact that the individuals who I was speaking to were not the historical figures who actually did the atrocities. and what I experienced is exactly what these statistics suggest, that they, individuals who I spoke with, the majority of them felt as if they had it worse and that they were being discriminated and oppressed against because we black folks won't leave the past in the past. Right.
You know what? And see, it really says something, Jim, when Emmett has given up on something because he's one of the most optimistic and hopeful people.
I know he
but
is.
You got to understand that he was burnt. He has been burnt, and we know of that experience. So, and we, you know, it became a national news. I think what was really interesting that, you know, to kick off Black History Month, you know, the Florida Governor DeSantis rolls out his, you know, rolls out his banded books. And I was so surprised. I need to say this, that Henry Louis Gates, everybody, Finding Your Roots guy, was here. But one of the things that we understand clearly by not only the data that certainly the article we read, that we have to understand that Christian nationalism is not about skin or color. It's, you know, it's really about whiteness, the values, the habits, the belief, the attitudes, you know, and it's a principle organizing, you know, you know, social determinant in how people see themselves. I mean, because what it does is it's never been about religion. So the point is that, and I think what happens is that I got to call all of three of you hypocrites. And the reason for that is because when it is soft pedaled, like in those ads last week that I fought vehemently against, that's the same. These are the same people pushing Christian nationalism.
You mean the Jesus ads on the
That's
Super Bowl
right.
and all
right.
across the internet?
That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
And these are the same people who feel that the judicial system and mass incarceration doesn't disproportionately impact people of color. So whether it is the sort of pushing the soft bigotry of Christian nationalism, like those ads that you pushed against me. Last week, or something as egregious as the data certainly is presenting, the outcome is very much the same. And I'm so glad, I just want to say, and I'm so glad that you got sick and tired of being sick and tired of telling and trying to convince an audience of folks that will not change their minds. That's why I just want to say one other thing. You have to push legislation because as a jaded minister, I have learned after a while, it's not about changing hearts so much as you hope to change behavior.
Just for the record, Jim, when you asked Emmett last week about those ads, Emmett, in the voice of Irene, suggested that he was absolutely opposed to them. So Irene has forgotten that I too was opposed.
Hey, Irene, when you say there's got to be legislation, you're not going to change hearts and minds, what does that mean? What are we talking about?
Well, what I mean is, it's like, you know, really making that clear, you know, demarcation between church and state. Get back to that. Because, so for instance, we got this story about the nuns who were rooting for the Eagles. And the point about
my
it is
my kind of nuns,
that,
but go
that's
ahead.
Right. I was rooting for them too. I was actually hoping for halftime.
Well,
I mean,
a Philly boy. You should, if you don't remember. So that's where I come from. But go ahead.
Oh, okay, okay. Well, listen. But the point about it is, what made that so wonderful reading about them, because it was a feel good story, is that if you are saying that, you know, football brings in all of America more than, you know, certainly religion and politics and certainly a state of an address by the president, it brings in people of faith and no faith, that if we understand it to be the religion, brings all of America, we got to make that clear distinction between church and state. And the slippery slopes of stuff that we've seen pass with the football, high school football coach allowing to, you know, to have prayer after a football game, and the
Supreme Court
flag.
So ruled, that's right.
Yeah. And the Supreme Court, you know, allowing a Christian flag at the state.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with you on that one.
May I interrupt you for a second, though?
Sure.
It's got to be all religions. I mean, it can't just
be. That's right. That's
exactly. Well, you last week said it was that women should be in trouble for showing the picture of Muhammad. Either it's Islam and Christianity and Judaism, or it's none of them.
No, that's a different.
It's not different.
I tell you what. Yes, it is. I tell you a couple of one. Number one is she is teaching a lesson. And I said that the whole idea was that she was supposed to create safe space. Emmett and I, when we discussed this issue, said something that was very, very important. That when we're talking about a religion outside of our own religion and knowing some of the incendiary stuff that comes with it, she never thought about bringing an imam in. I talked about having brought in the class that I was teaching a voodoo priestess, a Santeria, you know, priestess in. I think that it is not the same when you understand and you're trying to be inclusive of all people. I think what it speaks of, Marjorie, is just rampant white privilege being disrespectful.
All I'm saying, Irene, is you can't have one rule for Islam and one rule for Christianity.
No, I don't think it's apples and oranges.
That's what you're doing. It's either secular or it's not secular. It's not, we make an exception. But we should move on from this, because I want to know, you just said, Irene, that Emmett was burned in terms of white, this whole white nationalism thing.
Yeah.
Do you mind telling me what that means, Emmett?
Well, yeah.
No, Emmett.
I feel like he was,
Emmett,
yeah.
Which one of us?
Yeah, which Emmett do you want?
The real Emmett.
She said you were burned.
Yeah. I mean, you know, folks can go to the Boston Globe and type my name in with Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary, which is a white evangelical seminary. Back in 2021. Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, I just want to say this, when he took the post, I said, really, are they going to really welcome the kind of sort of inclusivity that you're talking about? And he, I don't know, I think he would have 5-6 years. Finally, you gave up. Thank you.
Well, it's clear one person wants to talk about this and one doesn't. So let's, Emmett, I know one thing you do want to talk about. I think you told us last week that a podcast was about to drop any day.
Yes.
So I assume it has. It's the Embrace, right?
It's coming about the Embrace. It's coming this Wednesday. It's a great episode. I know we're biased. A special episode for Black History Month. And it also brings into the notion of not only the Embrace, but questioning whether it's performative, whether it has substance, whether it has meaning. And also the notion of what do we do with this Embrace in the mind of having, the murder of Tyre Nichols, Saeed.
Faisal in Cambridge. Faisal in Cambridge.
In Cambridge, absolutely.
Yeah, so we bring all
here.
That together.
Marjorie, okay. You were there. Did you tell me off the air? I can't remember that you went to see it yesterday, and I went on
the way
to Hamilton with my kid one night, and we stopped by at night.
Yeah,
it was just beautiful.
Jim and I were downtown doing the actually the walk for the winter walk, for homeless. And I ended up going over there afterwards. First of all, it was packed with people,
really?
Which is kind of neat. Okay. Yeah, it was a nice day. It was getting warm. But the second thing is there were a few memorials for Tyree Nichols on the side with his picture and flowers and stuff like that. And it was just, there were a lot of people there. And I didn't hear anybody making any derogatory remarks. Well, the people seemed pretty enthralled.
But the good thing about it, because of these erotic, you know, references and stuff, it's bringing more and more people there. And that's what we want. We want people to make up their mind about the piece. And did you go under it, Marjorie?
I did. At nighttime, I did it. Oh, my God.
You feel embraced. Don't you feel embraced by it?
You do. Yeah. I mean, I get what people are talking about. But on the other hand, I think when you go to see that, you see these hands
more.
And you see these shoulders and
you get the whole thing instead of these little pieces. And by the way,
centering Black love. But I want to say this, though.
Quickly.
I do think that what would quell some of that, if they had a picture beside it,
yes.
that they actually, you don't think
I'm with you. Yes,
no.
I am.
This is not a literal,
I think it would be great to
We'll continue this next time. Now, Emmett, let me just say before you leave, in light of the fact you didn't watch the Super Bowl, my hometown team, the Eagles, won in a blowout. So that is the...
Congratulations, Jim.
Thank you very much. It's good to see you both.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Be well, you guys.
You look good, Emmett.
You do, Emmett.
He does. We've been speaking with Ira Munroe and Emmett Price. Reverend Ira Munroe is a syndicated religion columnist and the Boston voice of Detour's African-American Heritage Trail. Emmett G. Price III is founding pastor of Community of Love Christian Fellowship in Alston, the inaugural dean of Africana Studies at Berklee College of Music. Together, they host GBH's All Revved Up podcast. Coming up, we're going to open the lines to discuss one of my favorite things ever, or this is actually one of Jim's favorite things ever, but I'm kind of with him on it. Restaurants banning kids.
It's one of our favorite things. It's either hers or mine or...
Nettie Spaghetti in New Jersey just did that Nettie for Spaghetti. Any human being under 10 years old. The lines are open next. You think we should do that here? Under 10, you have to bring their little ID. They're not 10 years old. Out in the street.
I'm going to Nettie's tonight if you want to come with me, if you're free.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. The following is a rebroadcast of the program that was aired earlier today. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Tomorrow we're at the library for Ask the Mayor at 11, Ask the Attorney General. First time Andrea Campbell's there, at least as Attorney General. She'll be with us monthly, as the mayor already is, as the governor is, etc. I love this topic. If you're a parent of small kids, taking them out to eat at a nice local place, like, say, Nettie's House of Spaghetti, which is, I've never heard of this place, Tinton Falls, New Jersey.
Tinton Falls.
Might be, you've heard of it?
No.
Oh, might be a fine way to spend an evening. Except Nettie's has, you sitting down, all your parents out there, just banned all children under the age of 10, citing noise levels, lack of space for high chairs, cleaning up crazy messes, and the liability of kids running around the restaurant. So are you Team Nettie? I am. I think Marjorie is. Do kids belong in school and home and playgrounds, but not in a nice restaurant crying, yelling, and running around? Or are we being a little too uptight about our dining experiences, especially at a place called House of Spaghetti over there in Tinton Falls, New Jersey? 877-301-8970. We read a story that Kara Baskin wrote in the Globe years ago where there were a couple of restaurants in Boston, greater Boston, that banned young kids. The closest we could come was Rachel Miller, who the fabulous chef and restaurateur who I think is going to be with us as one of the Beard, I don't know what phase the Beard nominations are right now, but one of three women chefs, I think this Friday or next Friday at the library. Here's what their rule is. Well-behaved children with adventurous palates are welcome to dine at Nightshade Noodle Bar that's in Lynn. Please note, Nightshade Noodle Bar does not offer an a la carte menu. Therefore, all guests, including children, must participate in the tasting menu kind of thing. That's a step in the right direction, but I think it's pretty hard. We'll ask her when she's with us. If the kid is not well behaved, what do you walk over to the parents and say, you got to get out of the restaurant? Simplest thing is, under a certain age, I mean, by the way, there are a million restaurants, a family restaurant you can take a kid to.
Absolutely.
But a fairly nice thing where you're spending a decent amount of money, that, you know, either ban the kid or say, I don't know, after 5 o'clock. No little kids. Is that not reasonable?
Did you mention this 10 Tables restaurant in
Cambridge? No, I did not, which was a great place.
It was a 10 Tables kind of romantic restaurant in Cambridge.
Great place.
With just 10 tables. They had a kid, according to the owner there, an infant, who was screaming for 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. And these parents seemed to be totally oblivious to the whole thing. These people were so obnoxious. Did you read where they left their car running in the parking lot with the air conditioning on full speed so that they could just zip out into a cooled off car with their kid after their 45 minutes or an hour more of wailing? I mean, that's the problem. You get people that are real jerks. And when you get jerks, you're kind of stuck. So
I don't even understand. Well, I'm sure we'll hear from the other side, and we'll get to your calls in a second. What is the argument on the other side? There are a million restaurants that are family-friendly.
Yeah.
Why can't nicer restaurants that have a certain thing going that cost a little bit more, why can't it be an adults-only kind of thing? Again, if you really want to take a kid there, 5 o'clock, 5:30 is the cutoff, so that anytime, you know, at a reasonable dinner hour kind of thing, there are no kids.
Well, I guess the other thing is why, and we can all remember when our kids were little, you may have little kids right now, it's not much fun to go to a very nice restaurant. Yeah. We have to worry about, you know, keeping the kid occupied for the whole time you're there. It's not much fun to be worried about how you're disturbing all the other
Some people
diners.
Don't care. That's the problem.
Well, that's it. So they're kind of jerks, and so see you later. I mean, exactly. I feel bad for the people that have wonderful behaved kids, and 10 may be a little older. I mean, I think pretty much you can behave at a restaurant by the time you're 7. But
I was going to say 15. Quibble. But whatever it
15,
is.
15. 21.
No, maybe not 21.
They can't come till they can drink.
Till they can vote. Okay, let's go to Martha in West Roxbury. You're first on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about being like Nettie's House of Spaghetti in Tinton Falls. By the way, before you speak, Martha, if anybody in the audience has actually been to Nettie's House of Spaghetti in Tinton Falls, I mean this sincerely, tell whoever, I can't see who's screening the calls, whoever it is, ask him or her to put you at the top of the list. Go ahead, Martha. Sorry.
Oh, no, that's okay. I've never been to Nettie's, but I did just go to a restaurant local here in West Roxbury. It's very popular. It's very small. It's a Friday night, probably around 6:30. Tables are about 12 inches apart. There's about 10, maybe 11 tables in the whole place.
Yeah.
And the tables are, you know, it's intimate. So it was like a Chuck E. Cheese in there. We were tempted to get our stuff to go. We couldn't even, you know, relax because these kids were like right up against our elbows screaming. You know, I raised 3 kids in Boston. I would never think to bring a kid into a restaurant like that because it would be too stressful for me as a parent just watching people, you know, be pissed at me. And the kids, you know, I would be so stressed with my kids. It was not a relaxed situation.
Martha, I feel you expressed it so beautifully. Were any of the parents whose kids were making you have an unpleasant experience aware that their kids were destroying the fun for you and others?
Well, I mean, I felt bad for the mothers. You know, there were 2 young moms meeting there for dinner. I think they had 3 kids between them. And, you know, she did catch my eye. I was trying not to look at her. You know, she was like literally at my elbow. And I, you know, but she did, I caught her eye at one point and she, you know, like looked at me apologetically. But I'm like, well, what are you doing here? You know?
Exactly.
Like, yeah.
You know, Martha. This is so stressful for you, for me, for everybody.
You know,
Martha, that was great. Thank you.
A great call. It's one thing if you're on an airplane and there's really, I mean, there's a debate about whether they should be in business class, these little kids. But if you're on an airplane, you know, mom and dad have no choice. They got to take the kids with them. You have a lot of empathy
for
parents.
Why is there even a debate about business class? Put them in baggage. I mean, it's...
That's right.
I mean, really.
Put them down there with the dogs and cats and hope everything goes well.
We have to heat it because it's really cold.
You have to heat it. That's right. Baggage might be the way to go. But I do feel bad for them. But boy, taking your kid to a fancy restaurant.
Well, no, it doesn't need to be fancy. Like Martha described, an intimate dining place with, like, whatever she said.
You don't want to send them to an intimate dining place. That's
exactly.
Intimate. You want to send them to a big cavernous place. What was that place everybody used to go? Bugaboo Creek.
Bugaboo Creek in Watertown.
Yeah.
It's closed.
But they had a magic dancing.
It's your birthday. It's a bugaboo. Yeah, that one.
Dancing Christmas tree. The moose guy that danced. Yeah. I mean, it was clearly like a kid's restaurant. That's different.
That's different.
Anyway, we're talking about people that subject their little brats on the rest of the world, these fancy restaurants. What is wrong with these parents? 888. That's the number to call if you are contributing. 877-301-8970. You're listening to Boston Public Radio.
I got to reintroduce this segment really quickly because I think the next caller may have actually been to Nettie's House of Spaghetti. I'm not sure. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're talking about this restaurant in Jersey. And by the way, if you know of any restaurants in greater Boston, eastern Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, that do this, they have banned children under 10, and they're getting huge national play for this thing, including on the Drudge Report. It's going all over the place. And we want to know why we shouldn't do the same thing here with, you know, restaurants of a certain caliber, either small, as I think Martha was her name was saying, you know, intimate kind of things, or higher end kinds of things, and let kids go to all the family ones. It's great, but not this. Karen and Malden, have you been to Nettie's House of Spaghetti?
Hi, Jim. No, think that what I said might have been misunderstood.
It's okay.
I was looking at their Facebook page over the weekend because I saw a lot of kerfuffle about this on Facebook over the weekend. And a lot of the featured items they show on their Facebook page are definitely higher end.
They are.
Fancy seafood. So I can't speak for what the atmosphere is like there, but the menu certainly doesn't look like Prince House of Pizza on Route 1 or Mario's in Lexington or any of these places where it's perfectly acceptable to bring young kids. I just want to say I agree with you 100%. I am so sick of it. I can't stand when my friends pay for a sitter for a night out to get a break from their own kids, and they're spending all this extra money for childcare, and some other entitled, self-absorbed parent can't understand how wrong it is to have a child in a high-end restaurant. It's so rude. It is so self-absorbed. It's so inconsiderate for the people who do recognize that their children should be with a sitter that evening.
You know, I hadn't even thought of that aspect, Karen. That is doubly a good reason.
It
you're
is.
Paying big money to have a sitter at home, and you're, you have to suffer through the same crap, and it's not even your kids. Karen, thanks for the call.
Well, you know, the town in which, or city, I should say, in which the major offenders were located was, of course, Cambridge, and as one of our texters says, a lot of jerks in Cambridge.
Well, yeah, and by the way, I'm going to say something really good about a restaurant you've criticized me for criticizing. Yep. Marjorie's family goes to a fabulous restaurant in Somerset.
I'm going to get in trouble
for this is going to be a good thing. It's called Magone's.
Yep.
And by the way, it's a family-friendly place. I'm going to be nice.
Family-friendly place.
It's the kind of place you'd like to bring your family.
Especially if you have little kids that gamble.
Right, so they can play Keno at the tables. You stepped on my line. Exactly. You know, by the way, Marjorie said that, Egan family. I did not say that.
You got to lay off Magone's, Jim.
I didn't say anything. You're the one who said the little kids are going to gamble when they go there.
Okay. Where's the person that said that they waited on us, Jim? I've lost it.
Oh, I missed that.
Yeah, somebody said they waited on us at a place, but they really had a difficulty with kids that were really little kids coming there. Oh, here's Brendan from Worcester. I'm not bringing my three toddlers to Morton Steakhouse, but Nettie's House of Spaghetti, what do they expect? Now, the caller said Nettie's does not sound
I checked out the menu. Pasta is $28 or $30.
Yeah.
It's not a cheap restaurant, Nettie's.
Okay, here's the guy. Nick from West Roxbury. I have 15 years of experience in the restaurant business. He says he's served both of us, Jim, you and me.
Oh, this could
How about
be expand trouble.
On this? The restaurant should be more open to banning troublesome patrons. Too many times I've had to bend over backwards to terrible guests, people who harass the wait staff, and adults who literally urinate on the furniture.
Excuse me, really?
That's what Nick from West Roxbury says. But you know something? What? I mean, you waited on tables. I waited on tables for a long time. There are people who come out because they just want to give you a hard time. They love harassing the wait staff. And you can just tell. Those are the kind of people that would also bring little kids to continue the
harassment. You know what I did since the statute of limitation has run? When I was working at Grossinger's, a restaurant, a hotel in the Catskills, and I was a busboy and then a waiter or whatever, whenever I had a lot of people on salt-free diets because of health things, when anybody gave me a hard time, the next meal, when I served them, I added extra salt to every single item that they were eating.
And the next moment, they had to bring the ambulance in because the person had a stroke or a heart attack.
Well, they should have been nicer. They should have been kinder to the waitstaff.
Okay.
And it wouldn't happen. Let's go to Bob in Pembroke. We're talking about banning kids from certain restaurants. Hey there, Bob.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. Great topic.
Thank you.
I think the root cause is that it's very difficult to make people be considerate. And it's unfortunate in our society that we have to do that. And frankly, it's not really restaurants only. It's movie theaters.
You're totally right. You're totally
all
right.
sorts of places. And it's not just kids. A lot of adults are just as obnoxious in public places as kids are. So I think if we could all just be a little nicer and a little more thoughtful, it would be better for all of us.
You're a good person, Bob. That was very nice. Thank you. We should ban kids and obnoxious adults. I am totally with you. By the way, usually when we discuss this, which we do every 2 or 3 years on the radio, we have most of the people say that they think this is unfair to bar kids. I'm not looking at the text. Most of the people on which side?
No kids.
No kids. Great.
Yeah. Dan in Boston wants to bar everybody from bars. He says, I'm in my 40s, wish we had bars that were 30 and over. Who needs drunk 20-somethings ruining my good time? Somebody else says the real issue is selfish parents. Emily says, your kids are your choice, not my problem. I deserve to go spend my hard-earned money on a nice meal without being exposed to your little nightmares. So there you go.
Wow, beautifully put. It's very diplomatic. Let's go to Linda in Mendon. Hi, Linda.
Hello.
Hi.
First time, long time.
Thank you.
We were just down in Cape Coral visiting a friend, and there was a restaurant in Fort Myers that does not allow children, and it had a clever little sign on it that said, we do not have a children's menu, booster chairs, high chairs, or coloring books or crayons. For your dining pleasure, we suggest that you get a trusted babysitter to watch your children.
I love it.
And they did it in 2014, and so I Googled it, and I guess it's been there was a lot of furor when they did it, but it was in 2014, and they're still in business.
I love it. So, I think that's a beautiful message, and thanks for sharing it, and thanks for your first call, Linda. We really appreciate it. Do it again.
Kate in the car says, I went to an Italian family-style restaurant in West Roxbury for years with friends who had 3 young children. Every time we ate there, I left with indigestion and a headache. Kids not restrained at all. Besides being loud, they would attack the salad bar, and cheese cubes would be rolling under our table.
How much you love a good cheese cube. Go ahead.
Oh, God. At one point, I was notified by the parents I should boycott the restaurant because their children were subsequently banned. But she thought it was absolutely the right
decision.
Kids
were banned from the restaurant?
Well, I guess they were coming in and misbehaving, and the cheese cubes were running amok all over the place. Yeah. People were tripping over the cheese cubes. So the people that ran the restaurant finally said, enough is enough. I mean, there are enough family restaurants, aren't there, that people can go to without imposing themselves?
This is so unlike you, by the way. You're much more of a live and let live kind of person. I'm really proud of you that you're taking this position.
But if you're going out, you're going to spend $25, $35, $40 for a piece on a nice meal. You don't need to have a little kid screaming next to you, do you?
By the way, I just want to apologize to Marjorie for, I mentioned that she was wearing an apron before.
Yep.
And the next segment when we come back, we're going to talk really fast so she can get back to her baking. As quick, because I don't want the show to interrupt other responsibilities.
That's right.
She has.
I have a lot going on in my kitchen here, Jim. Okay. You're listening to Boston Public Radio. We'll be right back after this quick break.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We are talking about kids in restaurants and based upon this Nettie's House of Spaghetti in Tinton Falls, New Jersey. I don't know where that is. In New Jersey, obviously, which is banned kids under 10. I am stunned. I don't think we have had one caller. Lines are full. And I don't see texts where people are on the other side of this thing, which is a total shift, by the way, from what last time we discussed it a few years ago.
Well, some people are talking about, like Jason from Plymouth has an 8-year-old daughter, went to Gordon Ramsay's in the Back Bay in December for her birthday. She was all dressed up, best behavior. Mm-hmm. They accommodated her selective palate, and she wasn't the only young person there 9 o'clock on a Saturday night. But she's 8. I mean, they're saying 10 and under. I think they could. I mean, if you're 8 years old, you know how to behave by then. But I get exactly what people are talking about. They're mostly talking about little kids. Here's one that says, I'm all for child-free dining. I couldn't stand my own kids when they were under 10. Never mind other people's kids. I prefer to eat in peace. It's hard enough to go to a restaurant where you can hear the person across the table, you know, and then you have to listen to all these other kids shouting. I think it drives people nuts. Dave in Marblehead, thank you for calling.
Hi there.
Hey, Dave.
there's a restaurant in Gloucester that I think has an appropriate sign, and it says, unattended children will be given a cappuccino and a puppy.
Okay. Wait a minute. Good. I don't get it. I don't get it.
I do. Go ahead.
What do you mean they'd be given a puppy? So you could take them home and be harassed by the puppy? Is that the idea?
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay. Yes. Well, that's pretty good. You want them to be well-behaved. Dave, thank you for the call. That's
thank
the thing.
You
do want them to be well-behaved. This is Pam in Concord, New Hampshire, who says, I had a friend who thought it was cute when her 3-year-old daughter went from table to table saying hi and talking to other diners.
Oh.
Yeah, you know, it
get away. I mean, really.
I know, but some people have no clue. Some people take little kids to weddings, and the kid is 2 or 3 and running around disrupting things. They think it's fine. They think their kids are so cute. They think everybody else is going to think their kids are cute. Generally speaking, other people don't think their kids
Listen,
are cute.
You want to hear Zoe's pathetic message to us? Mm-hmm. This is our coworker. On the flip side, she writes, how are kids supposed to learn social skills, how to behave in a restaurant if they're not allowed? Are they just supposed to be quarantined to school in the playground until they're 15? The answer to that question is yes, Zoe, they are. They're supposed to be quarantined on a playground. And if you have any other questions like that, call me at home. Don't waste our time here. I mean, obviously, they should be quarantined. Let's go.
Well, maybe little Zoe was a perfect little model of behavior when she was a toddler at the restaurant.
I know Zoe a little bit. I would doubt that, sincerely. So Maria in Wisconsin. Let's go to Boston Public Radio. Hi, Maria. Oh, you're on Boston
Hi,
Public
how are
Radio.
You?
Oh, yeah, you're on the show. That's what I meant to say. I got a little confused there. Hi, Maria. Thanks for the call.
Hi, how are you today?
We're excellent.
Fine,
thank
thanks.
You.
Gary says hi.
Hi.
Gary from Wisconsin.
Hi,
oh,
Gary from
Gary.
Wisconsin.
Oh, wait, right. We love Gary. Hi, Maria. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, hi. I don't have children myself,
yeah.
But my husband and I, Gary and I do go to, you know, fine restaurants up here in Wisconsin from time to time. And, I cannot stand, well, first of all, I have no children, so I don't like children. And so when we go to restaurants
oh
and there
God.
Are little monsters running around, little germified booger pickers.
Don't hold it back,
touching
Maria.
Everything.
Yeah.
I can't stand it.
Yeah,
I want to just leave the restaurant, but I just keep it to myself and just say, oh.
Well, you're not keeping
it to
yourself.
I wish they'd hurry up and leave.
Yeah, yeah, that's a little extreme, Maria. I mean, we're very fond of you and Gary, but that is a tad extreme, and I'm sorry you don't like children, but I love children. I just don't want them at a dinner table if they're misbehaved. Maria, say hi. It's great to talk to you. Really appreciate it. You have any final thoughts, Marjorie?
Well, one of the texters suggests you just leave the kids on top of the car with the dog. They'll be fine.
That's what Mitt Romney did, didn't he?
Yeah. Seamus the dog.
Seamus
that's
the
right.
dog, right. He didn't
yeah,
leave the kids
yeah.
on. In all
and
fairness,
a lot of people talk about the parents seem to be oblivious. The kids are climbing over the booth. They're running all over the restaurant. They're getting in the way of the
exactly.
wait staff, tripping over the kids. I mean, I think that I would say it's 10 to 1. No kids in the restaurants.
Well, it's really edifying, don't you think?
I think maybe we could start a trend here, Jim, and everything will change because of us.
Do you have how many minutes people have to buy the Smug Mug? Nine and a half.
9.5 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
It.
We are done for today.
We're done.
Thank you very much for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can keep up with this 24/7 by way of our podcast, which, of course, is called Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow we've got a really great day at the Boston Public Library,
great.
Where,
yeah,
by the
great.
Way, you do not need tickets or make a reservation or anything. You just show up and stay for as little as long as you want. But tomorrow's a great day to go if you want to see the mayor and the attorney general in in person.
And you can ask a question from right there, by the
yep,
way. Right,
you, we have a homie mic. You can ask the question right from there. We have Ask the Two for tomorrow. We've got Mayor Michelle Wu from 11 to 12. And then we've got the new Attorney General, Andrea Campbell, from 1 to 2. We're also going to be joined by NBC Sports' Trenny Casey and Boston Globe love letter columnist for, of course, Valentine's Day.
All right, it's tomorrow.
Meredith Goldstein. We want to thank our crew, Zoe Matthews, Aidan Conley, Nicole Garcia. Additional support provided by Kenrick Mercado. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker. Brian Bell is on the boards for us today. Thank Brian Bell very much, as well as our executive producer, Jane Bologna. Anything else you'd like to add, Jim?
No.
Okay. Then what's the matter? What's so funny?
These texts about the mug are just really, it's just, they're so...
I tell you,
they're deep.
Think about how much joy the Smug Jim brings to hundreds and hundreds of people all around Boston, if not thousands, Jim.
But can I tell you something?
You're the smuggiest. They just love it.
The thing that is amazing to me, and I know we're running low on time, is not that we call it the Smug Mug, but when you go on the GBH news site, because my photograph looks a little... They call it the Smug Mug.
Well,
this is the preeminent
could you say,
public media outlet in the United
picture,
States.
You got to call them as they see him. You got to be truthful.
Okay.
You got to be a good journalist.
Enough.
Look at this man. What is
Thank
he?
Thank you. Okay,
he
Marjorie.
Is
you
smug.
May, okay, fine. We'll see you at the library tomorrow with Andrea Campbell and Mayor Wu. I'm Jim Browdy.
I'm Marjorie. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you can tune in tomorrow.
Bye.
If you didn't get the Smug Mug, I'm really sorry. Maybe next time. Bye.